We're surrounded by natural beauty in our region, from high snowy peaks to the pounding of the Pacific Ocean. With that kind of magnificence, you may not notice what goes on at the edges of an ecosystem. But where one ecosystem ends and another begins, there's a transition zone. And our next guest writes about that zone in his book, Boundary Layer, Exploring the Genius Between Worlds, now out on Oregon State University Press. Kem Luther is a naturalist and author who lives on Vancouver Island in British Columbia, and he's the author of the book. Thanks for joining us, Kem. Good to have you.
Oh, thanks for inviting me, Jeff.
You describe the Pacific Northwest as a living laboratory. Explain the concept, if you would.
Well, that's at the beginning of the book. I used to live in Ontario, and it seemed when I lived there that nature was more distant. It didn't affect our everyday decisions, our political decisions that much. But I moved out to the Pacific Northwest about 12 years ago, and it had more of a presence, nature did, than in Ontario. It seemed like it was influencing decisions out here.
I want to be clear, we are talking about Ontario, Canada, not either California or Oregon.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Sorry for the confusion.
No problem.
I live in two worlds. But it seemed out here that it was more present. And in that sense, I think the Pacific Northwest is a living laboratory. It's a place where we can discover our relationship to nature, and it maybe we'll discover something here that can be used in those places where people are not as connected.
So there are still things we have to learn, I mean, especially in the sense that we are not in a totally built-up environment as parts of the east of both the U.S. and Canada tend to be.
That's part of it, isn't it? There's more wilderness out here.
So with all there is to look at above ground, it sounds like what you're recommending in Boundary Layer is that we look down just a bit. Why is this so important?
I noticed when I came out to the Pacific Northwest and I would go for walks in the woods that there was a great deal of life on the ground. I actually had begun looking at this years ago when I was in Ontario. I wrote an article back then called Boundary Layer. I published it in a magazine. It was kind of a pun because in the article, I looked at the stuff that was in the top layer of soil, and to see it, I had to actually lay myself down. I had to get down near the ground. And so in that sense, I became a boundary layer, right?
Right.
That area along the ground is also known as the boundary layer. And when I came out to the Pacific Northwest, I began to notice that the boundary layer was penciled in green. It was very obvious. And on the forest floor, we found mosses and mushrooms and lichens and small vascular plants. And I began to wonder what their role was in the ecosystems. So that's how I came up with the term boundary layer in the book.
So you use the term stegnon too, and in fact the website that you're using for this effort is stegnon.com. So what is a stegnon?
Well, that's an invented word. The lichenologist Trevor Goward and myself worked on this word a few years ago. We wanted to come up with a term that would do for the land what the term plankton did for the sea. In the ocean, the basis of all life out there is plankton, these small microscopic creatures. And we often overlook plankton because we only see the bigger denizens of the sea, the fish and the mammals that live there. And the same thing is true on the land. The basis of all life is this layer along the ground. And we needed a term for it. So we came up with this term stegnon. It's built from a Greek word that means cover.
Okay. All right. It's interesting, and it's a made-up word, though, that you had a chance to come up with some of your own terminology here. But the idea being that, like the plankton is the bottom of the food chain in the ocean, there's stuff we need to look at as the beginnings of the food chain on land as well.
Yeah, it's the beginnings, but in some ways it's the sustainer of it as well. When we take a walk through the forest, our eyes are drawn to the larger inhabitants. We're drawn to the trees, our magnificent Douglas firs, and we tend to overlook this lower layer. We think of it as epiphytic. That's a word that biologists use. It's just a little something extra that's added. But when you begin to look more closely, this stuff, if you like, along the ground really is giving rise to the forest you see. It's calling the shots in the environment. In the chapter on mycorrhizal mushrooms, for example, I talk about this symbiotic relationship between fungi and plants. And almost every vascular plant, tree, and shrub you see out there in the forest has this symbiotic relationship with fungi underground. And without those fungi, the trees wouldn't be there. And we walk through the forest, we don't see this.
Kem Luther is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, naturalist and writer and author of the book Boundary Layer, Exploring the Genius Between Worlds, as we look at where one ecosystem ends and another begins and what's really sort of at the base that sustains us all. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. You were just talking about the interrelationships, particularly in the forest. And in fact, when you get to the forest in the book, there are pictures of living stumps. I mean, how does the boundary layer keep them alive?
Yeah, that surprised me when I came out here, because we had nothing like this in the East. As you're walking through the forests in Oregon and Washington and British Columbia, you'll occasionally see these two or three foot high stumps that are covered with moss, and they're actually alive if you take a saw and cut into it. You'll see that there are growth rings. They're very small, but this stump continues to live. And the question is, how can a stump live? A tree needs to photosynthesize. It needs to make sugars. It needs to it needs to gather nutrients from the environment. And a stump can't do that. And the answer is that these stumps are connected to the trees around them, but they're not directly connected. They're connected to a matrix of fungi, mushrooms.
It's like a borrowed circulatory system, in a sense.
Yeah, that's right. In a sense, these fungi constitute the circulatory system. That's a good word for it. I didn't use it in the book, but it makes sense. And the circulatory system is, in a sense, deciding who lives and who dies. And it is decided in the case of this living stump that it wasn't going to die. So it's actually being fed by the fungi, and the fungi are being fed by their relationship to the trees around them.
Symbiosis, then. Nobody's getting hurt by the relationship.
It is a form of symbiosis, yes.
So you take us to the beach first in the book, actually, before we get to the forest. What's in the boundary layer there, and given the pounding of the surf and all, how fast does it change?
I use the metaphor of a boundary layer in the book because I find that boundary layers come to have their own rules. They're areas that exist between two large stable systems, but when those stable systems come together, the friction, if you like, between them creates this boundary layer. And it used to be we thought of these boundary layers as simply combinations of what was going on in the bounding systems, but we've come to realize that they create their own rules. And when I look at the land along the edge of the Pacific in the Northwest, we see there a number of plants, a number of specific ecosystems that only exist because they're making their own rules between these two larger systems that are on land and on sea. And so we have some plants in this layer along the Pacific Ocean that don't exist anywhere else in the world. We have the best examples of them, but they have a very tenuous existence because the sea is always trying to reclaim the dunes where they live, and the land is trying to overgrow it with trees. And so they're having to fight off, if you like, the land and the sea on both sides to create their little space. And the weather systems and the natural cycles of plate tectonics conspire to keep this space open for them, and it's quite an experience to walk along the ocean and see these unusual plants and to figure out what their life cycles are.
Wouldn't you like to see a years long time lapse of the activity at the ocean front?
That would be good. it would certainly be a dynamic one. Some of these plants, for example, have disappeared, and we thought they were extinct. And 50 years later, they will come back, and it turns out that they've established themselves out on some island or some far coast where nobody notices them, and they send their seeds out on the ocean, and they come back on land, and all of a sudden they'll reappear. These plants have learned how to live in a dynamic environment that would destroy most terrestrial plants.
Kem Luther's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Boundary Layer, Exploring the Genius Between Worlds. He's a naturalist. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange and talk about the things that exist in those zones between ecosystems at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. So there are threats to boundary layers in a lot of places, largely because of people encroachment, as you point out. And particularly at the beach, you've got issues with non-native grasses, don't you?
Yes, that's one of the big problems is that when the European settlers came to the West Coast, they found that they didn't like the way sand behaved on the coast. It would, the wind was and the water was bringing sand up onto the beach, and the wind was bringing the sand onto the land, and it clogged their machines. It banked against the houses. It really was not very convenient, and they knew that. In Europe, this didn't happen because there was a special beach grass that lived along the sea that bound the sand. And so they actually imported this beach grass. And in the United States, there were programs supported by the government for years to plant this beach grass. But the problem is that this beach grass, once it takes hold, destroys the environment that these native plants need to survive. It takes over their space, if you like. And we've only come to realize this in the last 30 or 40 years. So we've begun to ask, how can we get rid of this beach grass that we've planted? And so there are programs both in Canada and in California to remove the beach grass and to let these native plants return.
It sounds like a tricky process, almost like trying to catch drops of water from a flood.
Mm. Yes. It is a difficult process to get rid of any invasive plant. However, when you do get rid of the beach grass, the native grasses don't have to be, the native plants don't have to be brought back by people. They come back naturally. But first of all, you have to get rid of the beach grass, and it's very hard to convince people that we need to get rid of this. In fact, here in Canada, in the removal program, when they were digging, they brought in these mechanical excavators to the beach to remove the beach grass, and some of the hotels in the area contacted them and asked if they could have the beach grass they were removing so they could plant it.
Okay, let's take a call here. We have Gene and Winston on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Kem Luther, the author of Boundary Layer.
Yes, hello. This is so interesting, and I guess maybe this is a kind of silly question, but I wonder if the insights that Mr. Luther, you have gained from your ecological studies could anyhow be applied to the problems of human society.
Yes, that's an interesting question. I address that a bit in the last chapter of the book. I treat in the first two-thirds of the book, a boundary layer is something specific in the environment. It's the fungi, it's the mosses. But in the last third of the book, I begin to talk about conceptual boundary layers, these layers that lie between large concepts. And specifically, I deal with the boundary layer between species and ecosystems. And then I deal with another boundary layer having to do with wilderness and wilderness designation. And those are the two I applied it to, but you could take this and apply it to many different parts of life. Did you have something specific in mind?
She's off the line.
Let me
move ahead, though, and ask about our knowledge, though, as humans of the ecosystems around us, and whether we know enough now to be able to work to restore the boundary layers you describe in the book.
Well, it's always hard to know when you know enough about an ecosystem to begin to manage that ecosystem. These things have managed themselves over millions and millions of years. And we don't always understand all of the interactions. With most ecosystems, when it comes down to managing them, usually park administrators and environmentalists take a fairly hands-off attitude, unless they spot something specific like beach grass that's come in to alter the environment. They want to let it evolve on its own. A rather famous example of this is Yellowstone Park, where they interfered with the natural cycles in Yellowstone by stopping the fires that would burn over every few years, and they built up in a sense a fire deficit, and then they had this mammoth fire. It was back in the 80s, wasn't it? And it wiped out about half of Yellowstone.
Nothing of wolf and bear management there as well, and some of the issues that that arose on the natural landscape from that.
Yes, exactly.
So, in some, then, I mean, do you hold the hope that we're paying more attention to the environment enough to be able to at least appreciate what's going on there? Or we still have a whole lot to learn.
Oh, we do, in the various areas I look at in the book, lichens and mushrooms and mosses. As I worked on these, I'm an amateur naturalist and a field naturalist, and I enjoy getting out and learning to identify the plants. But I began to realize that in certain areas we really don't have a very good handle yet on what's going on. For example, we think by extrapolation from vascular plants that there may be 10 million different kinds of fungi in the world, and we've only put names to a couple of 100,000 of them. So there's so much that we don't know. We haven't named. We don't even know what's there. So how do we know what role they play in the ecosystems? And that's why I say often naturalists take a hands-off attitude, because they realize what they don't know.
Well, there's a lot they don't know, true. And even if we catch up in science, there's also policy stuff that gets in there, too. It's real interesting stuff. Boundary layer, exploring the genius between worlds as we look at the boundaries between ecosystems. Kem Luther, the amateur naturalist from Vancouver Island, Canada, is its author and our guest on The Exchange today. Kem, thanks so much for joining us. Good to have you.
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me.